I'm Jonathan Green. This is Blueprint for Living. It's time for Lost and Found.
This week, Frozen. Now, Louis Georgiades is a chef, but his most recent posting, a job that ended in April this year, brought new meaning to the idea of frozen food. Louis, welcome.
Hi.
You were working at the British Antarctic Survey Base, Rothera Research Station. I mean, how long were you there for, and how cold is it?
As a whole, I was there for 3.5 years. I did two stints of 18 months and one of six. So it wasn't like I was there for 3.5 years straight. And it's not always as cold as you think. Some days it can get quite warm. You get up to about 7 or 8 degrees Celsius. But other days it gets down to, where I was, it gets down to minus 30 degrees C.
That's fairly serious. How many people were you cooking for?
It depends on the time of year. In midwinter, we dropped down to about 21, 22. And then in the full height of summer this last year, we cooked for 172 people. So fairly busy.
And there's a fair bit of planning needs to go into this because your supply lines are for most of the year tenuous.
Yes, it's critical, to be honest. It's one of the most important moments of the year is putting the order together for the forthcoming year, because we only get one delivery. So it's crucial that we spend plenty of time getting everything right, looking at numbers for the forthcoming season, looking at how many people are going to be on station, and making sure that we've got enough food for everybody.
I imagine you would need to cater a small surplus there.
Just a bit. It's, as a chef, it's one of those things I've done day in, day out in a normal restaurant world. But down there, having to plan so far ahead to make sure you've got enough food is just, it's a real daunting task to get your head around. And obviously, you need to make sure you've got plenty, just in case the ship doesn't arrive on time.
To have plenty and to have variety, enough to keep people who, for that winter, let's not forget, are in a fairly closed environment. If their food became tedious, that would be a difficulty upon that earlier imposition. That would not be a good thing.
No, completely not. It's I've quite often been referred to as the morale officer. You can literally make or break somebody's day with the meal that you turn out in the evening. And so it's crucial that we make sure we've got such a varied diet down there with all the food that we do have. It's important to look at it and decide how you can best use it to mix things up, if you like.
You must have pretty extraordinary storage to sock away a year's worth of supplies.
We do. We have two different dry stores located at different areas on a station. Heaven forbid you'd lose everything to a fire or any other major hazard. And then we also have, believe it or not, walk-in freezers. Everyone thinks that we could just put all the food outside, but with the fluctuations in the weather, it's really important to make sure we've got plenty of frozen food storage.
It's all very well to make that plan and to make that order, but sometimes those things go astray. Sometimes what you're expecting to get isn't what turns up. What happens then?
Well, you just got to live with it, to be honest. It has happened before. One year, we got no tinned tomato products whatsoever. So,
impossible.
All your lasagnas, yeah. Well, can you imagine? You've got no lasagna, no bolognese, all those dishes that you rely on for tinned tomatoes. You just got to make something up and do your best to improvise. And that's the biggest thing, really. It's all about improvising. With all the will in the world, you can make or lay your plans out to accommodate any situation, but something will always go wrong.
Give us a bit of a sense of a routine week of the menu across those days.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we start off at about 7 a.m. We provide breakfast for the guys, which consists of all sorts of fresh breads, pastries, cereals. And then for lunch, often it'll be hot offer. We'll do soup, sandwiches, maybe a hot dish. And then in the evening, it's really varied, to be honest. We do all sorts of dishes from Italian, Thai, Greek, English, French, you name it, we provide it, because there is only one place to eat at Rothera. So it's really important that we mix the menu up as much as possible. So I don't think there's anything we haven't had, really.
And you're catering to people with, I mean, they're engaged in a range of activities. So some people will be out working very hard physically, others will be indoors pottering about in their socks. So that there's a range of sort of calorie demand required there.
There is. And one of the things that we still do to this day is it's basically a snack that we do twice a day, and it's called Smoko. It goes back to the days of exploration when the men would be issued their tobacco ration. Nowadays, we just provide them a hot drink, and if it's in the morning, maybe some soup and fresh bread, or in the evening, we'd provide them with cakes or biscuits, something like that. So there's a constant supply of food. Some people don't need it, but others, if they've been working outdoors all day, they do need to keep their metabolism going with a higher level of food.
And I guess in this modern world with sensitivities and allergies and preferences, that's another layer of complication.
It is. And just like the real world, we have allergies and food dietary requirements too. This last year, we had over 20 different food allergens on station and different dietary requirements, and all of them were catered for.
Do you ever get sick of it? Do you need a day off?
We do get days off, and fortunately for me, we are allowed into the surrounding area. So I quite enjoy going off backcountry skiing around an area which has been deemed safe. We have a flag line which is 16 kilometres long. And it's been checked out by our field guides for crevasses. So we can go off into that area quite safely. And if it's a bad weather day, I might go off and work in a chippy shed and just go off and do a little bit of woodwork just to take my mind off things for a while.
But if the Antarctic chef ever says, I'm just going for a walk, I may be some time, then that probably sends the warning flags.
Well, that's it. But they all know where the kitchen is, so they wouldn't go hungry.
Lewis, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Lewis Georgiades.
My name is Marco, I'm 27, I come from Palermo, Sicily, and we are at Gelato Compa, 381 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy.
Sicilian gelato.
That's it. Sicilian gelato, differing from Italian gelato in creaminess and in selection of flavour as well.
Now, the thing we wanted to talk about too is Sicilian Sicilian granita, which is, well, this is a very special thing, and it has a whole lot of sort of ritual and custom around it.
Mm-hmm. So Sicilian granita, it's granita can be defined as sorbet. The Italian specification is sorbetto granito, so a grainy sorbet. So basically halfway between a drink and an ice cream, something that comes served in a cup and get consumed with a teaspoon. It's not as smooth as an ice cream or a sorbet, but it's got some little bits of ice crystals in it.
How do we change the size of that crystal? How does that crunchiness come?
Simply by increasing or decreasing the amount of sugar inside the recipe. Sorbet's got a higher amount of sugar, while granita's got a lower amount of sugar. Having a lower amount of sugar, more water mass, the crystals become bigger.
So if we take you back to Palermo, where does granita sit in your day?
Being a Palermitan, I will start with granita in the morning for breakfast. Even if in Palermo we got a very various way of having breakfasts, yes, we consume granita during the morning, but most of the times for me and for the Palermitans is good refreshment after day at the beach, for example. While on the eastern Sicilian side, Catania and Messina, it's a must starting with granita and brioche every morning for the 90 days of summertime.
Every day, it's a must.
We got more options, but yes, we do consume granita in the morning as well.
What kind of granita?
Granita in the morning can be coffee granita, chocolate granita, almond or lemon. I will define this for the top four, together with boysenberries. A boysenberry is only for probably a couple of weeks during the month of July in Sicily.
That almond granita is a very special thing. How do we make that?
It is very special because we believe that in Sicily we got the best variety of almonds. It's made out, can be made in different ways, but most of the times the principal ingredients are almond milk or water, sugar, and real almond, and then get transformed into almond meal.
It's a beautiful taste, and I mean, it is a thing that you will find nowhere else in the world.
Yeah. So
unless you're here.
I make it sometimes during summertime. considering the fact that it's winter time here, we are not at this stage producing almond granita, but yes, it's been one of the best sellers during summertime last season.
It's an amazing thing, though, that the selling of gelato and granita through the winter season, it never stops.
It's still going, yeah, especially during weekends. It's an amazing habit for Melbournians coming and having gelati, way much more than Italy, because in Italy it's really, really seasonal. So in wintertime, you probably have it once a month, while Melbournians, they got a good habit of having it in wintertime at least once a week, I would say.
This is good for you, Marco.
It's good for me, yes. I'm happy with that.
So in the gelati, the Sicilian varieties there, tell me a bit about that.
Comparing to the Northern Italian style gelato, the Sicilian gelato, it's a little bit less creamy and more intense in flavor. The selection of flavors is different as well, because while in Sicily we are more towards flavors like ricotta, and we use lots of fresh seasonal fruit, Northern Italian gelato, it's more towards custardy base, vanilla base, and a very creamy, eggy options. For example, mascarpone or tiramisu gelato, it's more a northern influenced gelato rather than being a southern one. I'll make it anyway, but yes, it's a northern one.
People underestimate the regionality of food in Italy. It is so distinct and I suspect very competitive.
It's very distinct and very, very diverse as well. For what I can talk well about Sicilian food, and throughout history we had 7 different dominations. So in our food, it's just, you know, a witness of what was going on during those centuries that goes on through the foods.
Gelati and granita must, though, be a reasonably recent innovation in Sicilian food.
The modern gelato, yes, it is a recent innovation. It only starts when the industrialization happened. So when we moved from simple instrument to machineries for reproducing the cold. But granita, I think it's at least 9 centuries old and starts in Sicily, introduced by the Arabs.
Where did they get the ice?
The ice was coming from the mountains. When, if you got the idea of Sicily as a very exotic island, but yeah, there are highest mountains in there. One of them is Mount Etna, which is the most active and highest volcano in Europe. So Greeks and Romans they had the chance to master the preserving and the commercializing of ice and snow. And throughout those techniques, then when the Arabs arrived, we got the introduction of the cane sugar, that together with the ice and the fruit juice, they were the 3 main ingredients for sorbet and granita as well.
And a legend was born.
Pretty much, yes.
Marco, thank you so very much.
Not a problem. My pleasure. Thanks. You're as cold as ice.
You're willing to sacrifice our love. You're listening to Lost and Found on Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green. And this week, Frozen. Matthew Bouillard is owner of Tasmanian Mountain Guides. Matthew, if we're wanting to spend some time in the Australian Alpine winter outdoors, what's our most important preparation?
Well, Jonathan, I think the most important preparation is your equipment and your understanding of where you're going. I think in Australia, a lot of people underestimate the environment that they're going into, which can be quite harsh and change quite quickly. So if you have a good understanding of where you're going and have taken some local advice and you've prepared your equipment properly, then you should have an event-free time.
Equipment, now what are we talking about there? How specific is the gear that we need in a cold place?
Well, the equipment will depend on the actual activity. Your clothing is very important. We like to teach people to use the layering system. So instead of having one large, heavy, warm jacket on, we have lots of different layers on, so we can take layers off. And really, we want to avoid sweating, which ends up making our clothes wet, and which is not good in a cold environment.
Now, well, indeed, and wetness is your enemy in the cold.
It is, absolutely, because it doesn't allow the garment that you're wearing to trap any of that warm air that your body's producing, and it also makes you a lot colder. So we try to avoid becoming wet, whether that's through sweat or whether that's through, you know, the natural environment making us sweat. So one of the main concerns we have is to avoid being wet and stay as dry as possible.
Now, we've been out for the day, we're making camp. How important is thinking about that campsite?
Well, in that environment, Jonathan, the campsite's very important. If we've planned to go out on a trip and actually camp out overnight, we'd be looking for some of the considerations we'd be looking for would be a nice sheltered area away from the wind. Obviously, that environment does attract a fair amount of weather, so we'd want to make sure that we sited our camp in a fairly nice, non-windy sort of area, fairly well covered. Fairly flat, it makes it easier to conduct yourself around the camp, so you're not worried about things rolling down a hill or a mountain. And also another consideration would be water supply. Although we're in a cold environment, we might even be in a snow environment, getting water can be quite problematic, so we'd like to be near a stream if possible to facilitate our cooking and our meals.
If we are in the snow and if we are caught out, and need to spend some time perhaps without a tent, the snow cave a good option?
The snow cave is a very good option, but the snow cave is a good option if you're understanding how to build one. The main thing in an environment where a cold environment where a survival becomes an issue is to get out of the weather and to get away from the wind. If you can do that somehow, then you're going to increase the chances of your survival. One of the first the easiest things to do in the snow is to basically dig a hole. You might dig something like a trench. If you can get away from that wind, you're very well on the way to to surviving, and then you can work all your way up to an elaborate shelter like a snow cave. If you have the equipment and you understand how to build one,
what do you need to know?
Well, there's some safety aspects that go with it. You don't want to build a cave and then be trapped in it. You don't want to build a cave and be in your cave cooking and then poison yourself with your stove fumes. You need to maintain an air supply so that you can breathe. So there's a few things to understand, before actually digging a hole and jumping into it.
And you want to be found at the other side of that too. I guess if you're digging a snow cave, there's a certain extremity in your situation, and maybe it's still snowing out there as well. So you want people to be able to see you.
Well, that's right. That's another consideration too. If you build a survival shelter and you have inclement weather, usually in that environment you're talking about lots of snow adding to the already, snowy conditions. You could trap yourself in. So, getting back to the knowing how to build a shelter, you'd really need to keep that in mind and make sure that you didn't build it too deep so that you ended up in a deep snow hole in the ground, which would make it hard for rescuers to find. At any shelter though that you did construct, you would need to leave something at the entrance, which is the standard, so that rescuers could see that there was actually something different and investigate and hopefully find you.
What's a good starting point for someone who's done some walking, done some camping, but wants to see to put themselves against the cold weather? What's a way to begin that as an adventure?
The way to start an adventure, if you're not used to the snow, is to maybe start with some day trips and get used to that environment. The snow is a very nice environment to operate in. You can carve the snow to suit, a campsite, or you can carve the snow to suit a tent. You can melt snow, albeit it's not very economical, but you can melt snow to, get yourself water. So just very slow, easy, small trips into that environment, or you can do a course with an organisation that runs either training or touring in that environment.
Because too much knowledge is not a bad thing.
Too much knowledge in that environment is not a bad thing at all. And every time you go on a trip, you learn. You'll always learn, no matter how many trips you do.
Matthew, thank you so very much.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Bouya. Dermot Molloy is a horticulturist at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria and a board member, the International Plant Propagators Society. Dermot, are there some plants that want to be frozen?
Not particularly frozen, but they might freeze seeds to make sure that you can use them again in a few years' time.
To keep those things.
To keep those seeds -20 in a freezer, and that way you can pull them out in 5 years' time and they are still viable.
Because some people will go through an annual ritual of putting their tulip bulbs, for example, in the fridge or freezer.
They put the tulips into the fridge in the crisper so that it mimics going through a winter.
In Australia, we don't have that sort of severity, of course.
Up in the hills where it's a lot colder, that's yep. when we have that really nice cold, and they probably don't have to put them into the crisper.
So what happens to that bulb in the crisper? What's it doing in there in the cold?
It tracks chilling hours. So a chilling hour is anything between 0 and 7. So it's not actually below freezing, and the plant tracks all the way through the winter. When it's had enough chilling hours, it's ready to grow again.
Here I come, world.
And it has to wait for the weather to warm up. So it goes through two types of dormancy. Endodormancy is when it's going through that cold period in the winter.
Yep.
And then it gets to ecodormancy where it's ready to grow, but the outside temperatures are too cold.
Now, tulips in our experience here is I suspect, a reasonably extreme example, or perhaps not. I mean, what sort of Australian plants are looking at that sort of cycle as well?
Not a lot, but we do treat seeds in certain ways that have to go through a winter, like Bursaria spinosa. It's a native shrub to Melbourne, and we put that into the fridge for 3 months. That replicates a winter. So we can harvest it in February and then put it through the fridge for a few months, and then it will germinate around late April.
I mean, there's a lot of plants that have that winter dormancy, of course.
Yes, it is. Yes.
What are they doing in that time?
In the winter dormancy, they are just basically tracking the chill hours and having a rest. So if they're deciduous, they're having a rest.
Mm.
They're just getting themselves organised to come out in spring and flush with buds again.
I wish we could do that as humans sometimes. And I guess we talk a lot about variations in climate and variations in season these days, and that must be interfering with some of those cycles.
In some ways, the chilling factor is actually making it a bit easier on plants, because chilling isn't below 0, it's above 0 and up to 7, as I said.
Mm.
And so as the climate warms, they don't require so much chilling hours to come out of dormancy.
Okay, so they're fairly relaxed about that.
Some of them are relaxed about it, yes.
Is there anything that will, you know, actually prevent a plant from emerging from that dormancy? Does it sometimes go wrong?
It can if your spring is really, really cold. Below freezing, it just won't come out of it. We don't often have that here in Australia, so
yes,
unless you're in the Alps.
If we're doing the crisper thing with bulbs or with seeds that require that to look at those winter hours for that plant, can we create an artificial environment for those plants? Can we arbitrarily tell them this is winter now, and when we take you out, it's going to be warmer, and it may be counter to the actual seasons?
You can do that. You can put your bulbs in the crisper in the middle of summer, and then you take them out, and in autumn they're going to be really confused, but they will probably come out into growth, but then they're going to hit another winter. So you'd have to grow those sorts of things under controlled environments.
So once you establish that cycle, you'd need to maintain it for that plant.
Yeah, it's very difficult. The plant knows what the seasons are doing and the day length and everything else, so it won't want to go dormant again after just coming out into leaf.
What a complex world they live in.
It is, yes.
it is a certain kind of intelligence.
Yes, it is. Plants are smart.
Dermot, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jonathan.
Dermot Malloy. Let it go!
Lost and Found has been a Blueprint for Living production. You heard from Louis Georgiades, chef, Marco Anea, gelato chef from Compa Fitzroy, Matthew Bouyar, owner of Tasmanian Mountain Guides, and Dermot Malloy, horticulturalist at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Victoria. Producers Amira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Chrissy Miltiadu. I'm Jonathan Green. The cold never bothered me anyway.